we have members. We have one issue on our agenda that originally I was kind of thinking we with these amendments with the dash twos we might be ready to kind of rock and roll. But there seems to have become some other interest in this bill. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2410, and Gina's going to get us get me the list. And while she's doing that, Patrick, why don't you give us a little rundown about this?
Glad you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2410 authorizes the Office of Emergency Management to establish a program for credentialing healthcare professionals for the purpose of voluntary service during emergencies. The bill provides that upon a declaration of a state of emergency by the governor, a credentialed healthcare professional who provides volunteer services is to be considered an agent of the Oregon Department of Administrative Services for the purpose of the Oregon Tort Claims Act. House Bill 2410 specifies that the department is to be assessed for the insurance so provided. It authorizes a public body to designate an uncredentialed healthcare professional as an agent under the Oregon Tort Claims Act for the purpose of providing healthcare services after a declaration of emergency by the governor. You'll notice in your packets that the dash two amendments are included, and those amendments eliminate the laundry list of seven different specified areas of healthcare workers and replace it with broader language that would encompass most licensed or certified healthcare providers. And I also spoke to Legislative Fiscal Office this morning, and they're still working on a fiscal impact statement, but they anticipate that the bill will have fiscal impact, although they're uncertain as to what specifically that will be at the time.
Okay. Patrick, does this have a subsequent referral?
It does not.
Okay, thank you. Okay, with that, then I'm going to ask Ken Murphy if he would go ahead and come on up, and since he's first on the list. And then we'll have Dr. Higginson, I'll have you come up next, and then Scott, you can come up third. Okay. And then anybody else that wants to speak on it will be, because those are the only three names I have on the list. Ken, whenever you're ready, go right ahead.
Good morning. Chair, for the record, my name is Ken Murphy. I'm the Deputy Director of Oregon Emergency Management, and I think probably once you hear all of our comments, it'll explain a little bit more. This bill has gained more interest, and as we move into the volunteer registry for healthcare workers, it opens up many questions, and I think we'll find, too, that Dr. Higginson and myself and people from Department of Justice and DAS Risk Management are still trying to figure out some of the best ways that we can discuss the issue of tort liability or how emergency service workers can be covered in the event that it does happen. But I am here in support of it in trying to bring to the table that healthcare workers are part of that defined group as we deal with emergencies. I think also it's important to note that as we go through this, we're looking at different ways of using the healthcare providers, no matter what their discipline may be, and to support an emergency. Now, in all honesty, I don't have any history of this ever being actually tested. We do have some volunteers that have come to us in different disciplines, such as bridge inspectors or building inspectors and that kind of thing, and that's all worked very well. We normally credential those folks, do background checks on them and that type of thing to make sure that they're properly credentialed and can do the work, but we've never actually had to do it with healthcare workers. So I think as we go through this, the issue that we'll have to resolve among ourselves here to make the bill viable will be the liability issue of a medical person providing some sort of medical service to an injured person during a disaster, and making sure that everyone is properly covered. So I just wanted to provide that information, and we support this legislation and hope that we can work through it. And we're still working with DAS Risk Management and Dr. Higginson and everybody on the fiscal impact, because we're not sure if that's something that we can already put them into Department of Human Services, some of their policies where they already have a policy to cover people, or this would have to be a new policy. So we're still working through that with Legislative Fiscal.
Okay.
So,
great. Are there any questions for Ken? Ken, I have a couple. or one in particular, and that has to do with the Oregon Good Samaritan law. And I apologize for not knowing the statute well enough to be able to cite you the where it is in there. But I do know that, you know, for example, you know, in the case of an accident, somebody with some medical training stops at the side of the road, offers some kind of first aid and that sort of thing. There's kind of an exemption from medical liability and that sort of thing because of the prudent person test sort of tends to be utilized. How would that come into play in this, or is the purpose of this to try to keep from sort of trying getting into the Good Samaritan sort of deal and figuring, you know, these people are credentialed to do what they do, they can do it without fear that they're going to have face some kind of retribution if there is an error made or somebody decides that, you know, a doctor that in good faith was trying to be helpful or another healthcare professional in good faith was trying to be helpful and somebody died.
Chair Crummell, I think in this case, like we do in most emergency management work, is we're trying to provide the healthcare professionals that upfront assurance, you know, number one, that they are properly credentialed and that hopefully that fear is eliminated,
right.
You know, that they will not be sued, you know, or challenged in a court of law for the medical that they have provided to a victim. So we're trying to eliminate that fear and anxiety ahead of time. And plus the second part of that is that we can bring people into an emergency quicker by going through this process of doing the volunteers and the credentialing ahead of time and working out the liability insurance issues, so therefore we can take care of our citizens and visitors quicker during a disaster.
Okay.
And I don't know the legal answer to how that would work with the Good Samaritan law, if that would protect them better or back it up in some way, shape, or form, but it just simply is a better way to credential and take care of people in the medical profession ahead of time.
Okay. Gotcha.
Okay. Keith Cutler is one of our attorney that works with us from the Department of Justice, and he can address that.
Oh, great.
Probably a little bit closer than I can.
And if you would state your name for the record, and then
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If you have an answer for it, that would be terrific.
Sure. Keith Cutler, the Department of Justice, Cutler spelled with a K. I was trying to sit in the background today because I assume nobody likes to hear from lawyers, but since you asked a legal question.
Sometimes it's necessary.
As you pointed out, Chair, Mr. Chair, the Good Samaritan law has to do, it applies when someone is literally finds somebody by the roadside and provides medical attention there. It's the statute, which I believe is around ORS 3800, talks in terms of volunteer providing the service without any expectation of remuneration. It's a pure kind of happenstance kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
What this bill is looking at is something a little bit different from coming upon an accident scene. It's after the emergency occurs when folks are starting to stream in to healthcare facilities. That's where there may be a need for many health resources to show up and to provide service.
Okay.
The Good Samaritan law would not cover that because it's at a healthcare facility, number one, even if everyone doesn't have any expectation of remuneration. So this fills a gap with respect to the aftermath of an emergency and sort of the immediate aftermath in terms of the treatment that may have to be provided at a healthcare facility as opposed to on the scene.
Okay. In your opinion, then would the bill, if it were enacted, also would cover people, I presume, on the scene, so that if people were actually dispatched to a scene, let's say a big building in Portland was attacked, and so there were a lot of injuries and that sort of thing, actually on the scene of the event, and people were dispatched there, this bill would cover them as well?
Yes, it would.
Okay. Have you looked at the Dash 2 amendments that we have?
Yes.
And does that, from a standpoint of the definition that we've that would be inserted there with the dash two, is that I mean, you guys are looking at that and kind of saying, yeah, this is okay, or as opposed, what I was trying to avoid and trying to sort of look at ways that we could have similar language in different parts of the statute, but what I was trying to see also is if we could sort of not omit somebody just because they weren't, that might want to be or might be able to be credentialed, but not be able to be credentialed because they weren't on the list.
Yeah. Chair Cromwell, I agree, and I worked with your committee administrator on this and talked to Dr. Higginson and other folks, and, you know, and it just made good sense to have an overarching statement that included the entire health care, because as we've learned in any emergencies, you know, you just never know what type of discipline, whether it be medical or other, that you need. And trying to list every single doctor or discipline in the medical field, I'm sure we probably missed somebody. And so I think the amendment is proper and will serve us the best.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Are there any other questions? Representative Przanski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since the attorney, Mr. Cutler, is now at the table, I'm glad. I'm wondering if you could just walk us through as a committee how this would actually be implemented. I understand we have an emergency that's declared, and then if either of you can walk me through as to how an individual, I assume they're going to be somehow pre-screened and licensed or shown that they're capable to do whatever work we want them to do. And then secondly, if someone wanted to challenge the services they received, what, if any, steps they could take, or what would be required under the Tort Act, so we can set a record as to exactly what would be the ramifications of this type of legislation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, I think Dr. Higginson is going to go into the mechanics in more detail.
That would be fine.
So I'll defer that to him.
Okay.
Thank you. As for the second question about the mechanics of someone who receives treatment that they believe is actionable, the result would be, as currently drafted, the result would be the same as any other tort against a public body official.
120-day notice or whatever is required prior to suit.
Yeah, they could file the tort claim notice and then ultimately a lawsuit alleging the tort.
Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Nelson?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. Murphy and Mr. Cutler, for current emergencies in our state, what is the policy?
Chair Cromwell, Representative Nelson, normally the current policies that we deal with, if a person is hurt in a, you know, or in a disaster, they're normally attended to by emergency medical technicians that would arrive at a scene with a fire department or an ambulance service agency and then transported to a hospital. I don't have any personal history that I could describe to you. I don't think we've had any disasters of great significance that we've had many injuries at one time. I know during the floods of 96 and those type of things, personnel were either treated at the scene, there was nothing that serious, or they were transported to a hospital. And there was never a great surge of medical need where we had to actually bring together medical people to a scene.
Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Mr. Murphy, for example, if you took Mount St. Helens and the number of people there who were evacuated and several injured, wouldn't these individuals already be covered by county, state, whatever their facility is? As a commercial operator, I believe all of those are covered by their own companies who mm-hmm. responded in that case. So I'm just wondering if there is a necessity to have an additional burden.
I might defer to Keith here and get into the legal side.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson. Let's keep in mind the kind of disaster we're envisioning we've never had, and you know, let's be thankful about that. Even in the Mount St. Helens situation, as far as I know, there was no inundation of healthcare facilities after the emergency of the magnitude that, for example, happened in could have happened in New York on September 11th of 2001. you're absolutely correct, Representative Nelson, that the healthcare facilities have their own coverage, that folks who are working there in their regular course of business are covered in whatever manner they currently are. And this bill doesn't affect that at all. This bill has solely to do with after an event when we might expect and hope that many healthcare providers would voluntarily show up and provide service, that this would provide coverage to them. Today, if we were to have such an event, we would still hope that many healthcare providers would show up and provide service if that was necessary. If they did that, the healthcare facility has no idea who these people are who are showing up. The healthcare facility then has to make some kind of a decision as to whether they should allow these people in to provide services on their premises. This bill would, first of all, and as Dr. Higginson I think will describe in more detail, it would establish a process before an event ever happens so that the healthcare facility can know whether the folks who are showing up are people they want to let in and provide service on their grounds. And then to the extent those people who are coming to provide service in this emergency are on this registry and are volunteering their services as opposed to providing services in the normal course of their business, they would be covered by this bill.
And the last question, please.
Follow up.
Thank you for that information. I'm wondering for organizations like Northwest Medical Teams and who volunteer, and you know, it's, their work is not totally international here in the United States as well. Do you know? Are you familiar with the way their program works?
Chair Cromer, Representative Nelson, no, I'm not. The only familiarity I have with one group is out of the disaster medical assistance team located here in Oregon. Most states have them, and when they are activated, they come under the protection of federal law when they go to any state.
Is that FEMA?
Yeah, it's through FEMA, and they have different teams around the country, and they spend a certain time on an alert status each month. They can deploy anywhere in the United States for a disaster. But once they do that and they're mobilized, they're covered under federal law. But I'm not familiar with Northwest Medical Teams.
Did you have something to add, Mr. Cutler?
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Please.
There's a variety of potential providers out there who may be covered by different laws. I mean, for example, Mr. Murphy has just described one aspect of some of these providers who may be covered by federal disaster laws administered by FEMA. There is also a federal act that has been never interpreted by courts, so I'm not exactly sure of what its reach is, but it's called the Federal Volunteer Protection Act. And I'm pretty sure that that act would cover an organized team like Northwest Medical Teams that's set up as a volunteer organization. I think that same act, for example, covers American Red Cross when they appear at disasters and provide the services that they provide. This bill is intended to fill gaps. You know, it grows out of the so-called gap analysis that we did following September 11th of 2001. To the extent that the Federal Volunteer Protection Act wouldn't cover, to the extent that the coverage from other federal acts wouldn't cover, to the extent that folks coming from other states under the Emergency Management Assistance Compact that was enacted in the first special session last year wouldn't cover some of those folks, this fills the gap of people who are left. That is, providers who are volunteering from inside the state.
I would point out from a disaster standpoint, probably the closest that we've ever come would have been when the United flight crashed in at 107th and Burnside in Portland on its way into PDX. Luckily, only about 10 people were killed. But there were a number of injuries, and very easily Portland Adventist, which was the closest facility, very easily could have been inundated, and they would have needed to have some kind of assistance. Now it turns out that they didn't, and most of the injuries and everything were taken care of by emergency medical personnel on the scene, and then whomever was transported immediately over to Portland Adventist Hospital. But that could have turned into a real disaster had it been a situation, for example, if the plane would have exploded, had more lives on the flight lost, or more homes lost with people in them and that sort of thing. It actually did crash fairly close to an apartment complex. So that would be, and that's a very small scale compared to what this bill, I think, is envisioning. And so I don't know if that helps or hurts your case, but anyway. Any other questions for these two gentlemen? Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Higginson, if you would, come on up, please. And then do you want to have Scott come up with you? That'd be fine.
I'm just buying a card.
One thing about having you as his bodyguard, Scott, he's, you're small, but you're slow. Is that?
His ankles are protected.
Good morning, Chair Crummell, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the State Public Health Officer with the Department of Human Services. And I'm here today strongly in support of the concept of House Bill 2410. There's actually some revised language that has not made it through as a formal amendment yet, but that I'm passing out that we're really in support of. But the concept is the same. And as you pointed out and had pointed out to you, there is a Good Samaritan law. However, it is really quite limited and specifically deals with those the care that's provided outside of healthcare facilities. And what we're trying to do here and what we would want to be able to do in any emergency disaster situation is to try to get as many people to the best care possible, and that would be in a healthcare facility. So to make sure that people are covered when they're provided volunteer services in those facilities is a very important concept for us. As I think we all recognize, you know, after the September 11th attacks and then the anthrax attacks that followed, it really did change our world forever and how we look at things. And one thing that became very clear is that there are a number of laws, both at the national level and at the state level, that really are not as protective as they should be if we want to protect the safety and health of our populations. And so consequently, the Governor's Security Council that's responsible for looking into anti-terrorist activities asked the State Department of Justice, the Attorney General, if they would look into our current laws and do a gap analysis, as Mr. Cutler said, to see what things we might need changed. What the Department of Justice identified, was over 250 potential legislative issues, and then through a process where they had state agency folks, local partners, other key stakeholders take a look at this. This group of issues was narrowed down to about 15 critical issues. And these then 15 critical issues were given out to a number of work groups to look at. One of the work groups that we were very involved with was our Health Preparedness Advisory Committee that advises us on bioterrorism grants that we've received from the federal government. And they were asked to look at four issues. One of the four issues they were asked to look at, and one of the things that has always been seen as a very critical issue, was this whole area of liability coverage for healthcare workers who are volunteering during a disaster or an emergency. There was a Committee on Justice ad hoc work group that was pulled together to also take a look at this issue, and I participated on that work group, and it was from that work group that came this language that is currently before you in House Bill 2410. The Health Preparedness Advisory Committee then took a look at that work, and from that discussion that we had at our HPAC meeting have come up with the alternative language that you see before you. We can talk about that as we go through. As was mentioned earlier, when there is a disaster, there is a way to get some health care provider support into the state that are covered from outside state resources. There is a disaster medical assistance team program so that when an emergency is declared, we can get those federal resources into the state of Oregon, and they are covered under federal liability. Also, if the state declares an emergency, we can get resources for health care providers as well as resources for a number of issues through the Emergency Management Assistance Compact. And again, when those resources come in, their liability is covered. But currently, as you've heard, there is no way right now for volunteer health care providers within the state of Oregon to be covered by State Tort Claims Act for services that they're providing voluntarily to help out during an emergency. So that's exactly what we're trying to do here with this bill, and what we're trying to do as described in the revised language that you have before you is two things. First, we want to set up a registration system so that we have a pool of healthcare providers so that we can call on if specific issues come up that we need help with. So for instance, if all of a sudden there were a case of smallpox and we needed to do some mass vaccinations, to be able to have a pool of registered healthcare providers that could be called upon to come help us with some voluntary mass immunization clinics, then they would be able to do that, and they would be covered under State Tort Claims Act in regards to their liability. So that's the one piece of it. And then the second piece is if there were a major disaster where a lot more resources were needed, this also provides that as long as a volunteer is presenting themselves to what we're calling an emergency medical facility, then they would be covered as well. An emergency medical facility would be any hospital that has an emergency plan, an emergency credentialing plan that has been accepted by the Office of Emergency Management. A question has come up in regards to the fiscal impact this bill would have. We assume that this really is already covered under whatever provisions there are for emergency declarations under ORS 401. So we figured that there would be very little in the way of fiscal impact. We've heard recently from DAS that this may not be the case, and so we do have to do some additional work to figure out exactly how much it would cost, and we're hoping that even eventually we'll be able to show that it's a minimal cost. We also have been in discussions through the Health Preparedness Advisory Committee and outside that process as well with the Medical Association, with the Hospital Association of others. There's still some issues with the language that they would like to see cleared up. And so consequently, what we're really asking for you to take a look at the proposed language. Hopefully that is something that this committee will say that that's a good idea to move forward with, and ask that a work group be formed to look at the fiscal impact issue, as well as try to clean up the language so that we're all happy with that. And with that, I'll close and be happy to answer questions, either before or after Scott.
Let me go ahead and have Scott, if you would.
Sure.
Scott, and then we'll open it up for questions for both of them.
This is really kind of an ongoing story that did start. I'm sorry, Scott Gallant, Oregon Medical Association. I represent 6,600 physicians. This is kind of a ongoing story that did start in September of 01 with the attack in New York, and has been in process through last year and the adoption by the state legislature in the first special session on an interstate compact that the Department of Justice recommended and many states have adopted. Part of the provisions of that, and to put this in context, none of these things would go into effect unless the governor declared a state of emergency. So this is not a circumstance that is thought of lightly. The authority of the governor to do that, and if implemented, establishes great authority and police powers in the governor to run and operate just about anything in the state. And it's essentially, I guess to view it in general terms, would be like World War II and the authority of the president under those terms. So it's a very serious decision, and only
would be used, obviously, if there was some major catastrophe. But in the Interstate Compact Act, which has been adopted, the governor has the authority to ask other states to send personnel, including medical personnel, to the state and others to assist in treating, rebuilding, or other activities in a disaster, whether it's an attack or a natural disaster. Those individuals would be under the State Tort Claims Act for the purposes of someone being sued, if they so chose, after an event. I don't think it's very likely that that would happen, but one can always be surprised by some in that process. So though that would include anyone who was directed or who is a state or government employee within the state who is operating in that circumstance would also be under the State Tort Claims Act. It's hard to say in a repetitious way. But the only individuals who are not under provided coverage, other than the Good Samaritan law, are in-state healthcare personnel who might volunteer to assist, and I think they would anyway, to help those who are injured because of either a terrorist attack or some other natural disaster. We had proposed during the first special session an amendment to the Interstate Compact Act that their language be added to say essentially that the governor could indemnify health care providers from ordinary negligence if there was a declared emergency and physicians or others volunteer their services, et cetera, et cetera. The Attorney General did not believe, because the Interstate Compact is the compact, that it was appropriate for uniformity purposes to amend that provision. And so I think out of that process, a work group was put together to see what other alternatives might be available. And Grant Higginson and the DOJ and others have been working to put a bill together to try to address that, and that's where this is coming from. To kind of answer the question about the Good Samaritan law, the Good Samaritan law provides the negligence standard is gross negligence, which is specifically defined by common law and law as a higher standard than the ordinary course of providing medical services. Okay. This legislation does not change the standard that one might be sued under. I would suggest that you might want to consider using the same standard because it would be an extraordinary circumstance, I think, and something that you ought to consider. But in the process of just kind of having plenty of time on my hands, we asked Bob Moore, who's a Republican pollster, to inquire generally what the public might think about providing protection to physicians and other health care providers who treat Oregonians injured in a terrorist attack or natural disaster from medical malpractice lawsuits. 70% of those polled in January, statewide poll, plus or minus 4%, support the concept of providing some kind of malpractice liability protection. I think most ordinary people would logically say, you know, it's probably a good policy. Mm-hmm. And if you really think through the myriad of laws that are currently on the books, federally or otherwise, it makes sense that you ought to, as a matter of policy, include those who live in the state, who will most immediately be there to help individuals to be have some assurance of protection other than the Good Samaritan law, even though that is fairly a significant protection. That this should be a consistent policy across all those that you're asking to go in the fray and help. So I think you have wide public support, is my point. The bill itself, and there are actually two bills in play. There's another bill in the House committee that is attempting to define what a emerging health crisis is, And that bill needs significant work to again figure out the scope of the authority of the governor and to whom he delegates in determining what that might be, and the authority of the state over healthcare personnel in that process, and directing facilities, physicians, nurses, about anybody who walks and talks in healthcare to deal with, and I don't mean this lightly, but it is a very expansive authority to direct by the authority of the state to do certain things in dealing with either natural disasters, terrorist attacks, biological, chemical, or otherwise that might occur in our unfortunate world that we have today. So in combination, this bill alludes to that legislation. That legislation needs some significant work. We believe this bill does in trying to define and figure out a process that is logical, that you have pre-planning, that the state and providers know what the process is. It's easy, it's logical, and it doesn't discourage providers from doing what they should be doing anyway. And by that I mean, for example, all physicians, for the most part, who deal with hospitals are already credentialed. And they're credentialed for particular things. Usually it's unrestricted or whatever. But my point is that you want to create a system that is simple, and you also don't want to discourage individuals from going to facilities, given their particular skills, to deal with the event that's going on, and so that it is easily usable for individuals who may not have gone to the trouble of going ahead and registering, but you can still have their services in case they show up at the facility. I've always imagined, for example, the OMA office is on McAdam Avenue in Portland, and in the medical school, of course, you have Barber, and then you have the medical school above that on the hill. Well, if you had some event occur, I don't know if any of you know about what the traffic is like there, but you can stop. I mean, if you had traffic stop there, you cannot go anywhere unless you happen to have a spare helicopter on you. So realistically, you would probably have individuals helping individuals on the streets, with people trying to figure out how to transport people to facilities, probably by helicopter, and you would have physicians and others volunteering in very unusual circumstances. So it's going to be very difficult for people to just get to the facilities, and you want to make sure that this is flexible enough so that if you have someone who may not ordinarily, let's say you have a heart surgeon who doesn't ordinarily work on trying to triage someone with a broken leg, you don't want them to be discouraged from saying, we've got to get this stabilized and move ahead. So this bill, instead of going into all the details of it, but it needs a lot of work. I think with your support and recommendation, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would truly suggest that that we have a work group get together, work out the details of this bill, and bring it back in some kind of consensus form for you to rip apart or toss out, so that it's, I think, a little cleaner than it is at the moment.
Okay, thank you. Representative Avakian?
I had just a few questions, if I could just move through them.
Sure.
Thanks. under your amendments in Section 2, where you add persons licensed, certified, and then the language or otherwise authorized or permitted, who are you envisioning that would fit that category that's not a licensed or a certified professional?
Uh, Chair Crummell, representative of Ocken, I'm actually not sure who that would be, because I think what you're saying is almost everyone is licensed or certified to provide those services. I believe that this language, though, actually came at the request of Representative Crummell, that we put in that language, and the idea was, rather than having a laundry list of everyone who we thought might be appropriate, and with the possibility of leaving someone out, the idea was to have language that was very permissive, and then either by rule or by policies and procedures, we can figure out who would be the most appropriate people to include. So it was really, the idea was to leave this open so that we could include everybody that needed to be included.
Okay. Under the next one, Section 3, I'm having trouble figuring where this definition of a healthcare facility would fit into the original Section 3 of the bill, first, and then second, why it would be necessary to have a definition of a healthcare facility anyway.
Okay, and Chair Crummell, Representative Avakian, one thing that we need to make sure is that if we're providing liability coverage for people who are going to be volunteering, that the state does put itself at some risk, and so we need to make sure that there is some check and balance, so that for instance, a podiatrist couldn't say in an emergency, well, I'm going to go set up a field hospital on Tomacall Park. I mean that's the kind of thing that we can't have. There has to be some structure, so that we at the state know that the services are being provided in a manner and in hopefully a facility where there is some quality health care being provided. At one point we thought, well, one way around that would be to make sure that anyone who was going to be providing those services was somehow credentialed through the state. Through the discussions that we had with the Health Preparedness Advisory Committee, one thing they said was, well, hospitals and health facilities already have that credentialing procedure, so why can't we rely on them to be doing that? So that's where the idea came from, that let's use the hospitals, their existing emergency plans, their existing emergency credentialing procedures, as a place to make sure that is where health professionals would come to be accepted to provide the care, so that there was some quality assurance in the system that we're setting up.
And then look down to sections 4 and 7 together, if you could, on your amendments. In section 4, it allows for this registry of licensed providers to provide services during, and then the terms emergency or crisis is used. Down in Section 7, when we're talking about providers that maybe are not on that registry, it defines it as an emergency when the governor declares a state of emergency. And I'm wondering if you were intending to make a distinction between when the licensed or certified and the people who are registered would be providing service, maybe during a time when the governor had not declared a state of emergency, and when the others that were not on the registry were able to participate.
Right. Chair Crummell, Representative Avakian, that is exactly what we're trying to do here. In Section 4, set up a system where it's not a major disaster. It is not something where we're expecting we're going to need hundreds or thousands of healthcare providers to come help us with, but it's a more limited issue. Still a disaster could have been declared, or there could be the state of impending public health crisis, which Mr. Gallant mentioned a moment ago. But in those cases, we would like to be able to have a pool of healthcare providers that we could draw upon. I mentioned the possibility of using them for mass vaccinations. In the 1996 floods that we had the need to set up a couple of clinics in rural coastal counties to help provide services where basically the clinics had been washed away, and we did not have the ability to be able to mobilize anyone to do that for the state. We ended up actually getting some federal volunteers to come in and do that for us. But to have this pool of people that we can rely upon that are pre-registered, so we know who they are, what they can do, and pull upon them for a minor more minor situation, that's what we're trying to deal with in number four. And then in number seven, what we're saying, this is in section seven, this is a case where there's a major disaster where lots of people may be needed, you know, far outstripping what resources we would have from that registered pool of individuals, and there we want to make sure that they would be covered if they're providing care within some kind of limits.
And you would anticipate some type of a rulemaking process, I suppose, to decide what types of professionals would qualify for the registry and which wouldn't?
Chair Cummel, Representative Vlachian, yes, we would have I'm assuming we would have a rulemaking process where more of this was spelled out.
And, Mr. Chair, just one more question, and I'm not sure if it's appropriate for the two of you, but I don't know who is on our list to testify. I'm wondering if in a situation where these people come to volunteer, but it's an interesting term to use since they're acting under the color of state law under this statute. If they're injured in the course, whether or not they're covered by our state's workers' compensation policy.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Vlachian, that I'm not qualified to answer in that.
In the back of the room with Spark, and I didn't know if you were signed up to testify or not, but it just brings up another interesting notion of the bill, that even though, you know, the liability portion is taken care of because they're covered by the Tort Claims Act, how are those people protected if they're dealing with infectious diseases or other dangerous situations?
And Mr. Chair and Representative Vlachian, I'm assuming that was part of the thinking why we got a higher fiscal impact statement from DAS Risk Management than we were expecting, and I'm not sure if David or someone else could address that now or not. No. We'll have to get back to you on that.
Anything else?
Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Representative Nelson?
Follow up Representative Vlachian, I think those were excellent questions. But just a few smaller questions. I'm curious who makes the acceptance of these individuals. I don't see anything in here who determines who will be accepted for the list and denied, and if so, you know, who, how do they appeal, or, you know, I'm thinking, for example, of chiropractors versus MDs, that sort of thing. Who will make that decision of who gets accepted?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, the authority here is for setting up the registry is given to the Office of Emergency Management, so they would be doing that unless they were to delegate that responsibility to someone else, and actually our provisions, they could delegate it to us as a state public health agency. And I think if it were our responsibility, that, you know, what we would do is try to think of all of the different situations where we might be wanting to deploy people, so vaccination clinics, you know, regular general care clinics, triage for trauma, severe trauma issues, those kind of things, and from that, then, you know, come up with a list of professions that we thought were appropriate. But like I say, we want to have a group of people working with us to come up with a broad listing of people so we can include as many appropriate professionals as possible.
Follow up. And I
talked
about in the bill, as I understood it, I believe that these are current licensed personnel, so I'm assuming that you're going to also consider those who are retired, possibly medical students. Is that true?
Chair Cummel, Representative Nelson, yes, I believe that would be true, although I'm not sure we could do medical students because they aren't licensed or certified, but retired health care providers certainly could. In fact, one of the programs that the federal government is pushing is this Medical Reserve Corps, and we have two of those going on in Oregon, and those Medical Reserve Corps units, plus our one disaster medical assistance team, we're seeing as really would be that core of the registered pool of healthcare professionals. And so since Medical Reserve Corps can use retired physicians, they certainly would be potentially included in this.
Potentially medical residents who are, in fact, licensed would possibly be able.
Thank you. May I continue, Mr. Chair? And with this, I don't see any relationship to the military personnel of our state. who may not be practicing physicians. And as well as I don't see a reference to ancillary professionals, i.e. pharmacists, ambulance company drivers, transport companies, Civil Air Patrol. Are those also going to be licensed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, on the original bill, when there was a listing of health care professionals to be included, pharmacists and EMTs were definitely on that list, so that they clearly are groups of people that we would need to utilize. And also on the disaster medical assistance team, they utilize both EMTs and pharmacists as well. On the first question asking about the National Guard, the National Guard is a tremendous resource, and we since October of 2001 have had weekly meetings with a core group of agency folks to be working on anti-terrorist issues, and that group has included the public health, emergency management really heads it, state police, and the National Guard. So they're clearly a resource that we would want to be able to use. There are some problems right now with them being able to provide health care services to the general population. That's something that we're working with them to try to clear those issues up, but we do see them as a resource, and whether or not they're included in this bill, would use them in the case of an emergency if we could.
Let me also jump in here for a second. One of the reasons why I asked for the -2 amendment to be drafted with the language starting at the end of line 1 and through line 4, professional means a person licensed, certified, or otherwise authorized by the laws of the state to administer medical or mental health services in the ordinary course of business or practice of a profession, is precisely so that we didn't leave somebody off of the list that had been proposed, but rather to make sure that all potential medical providers would have the opportunity to volunteer and become credentialed by the Office of Emergency Management.
And
let me also just jump in here and say that the language that you had proposed in your section 2 of your proposed amendments, that language mirrors very closely what's in the -2s, and the language in the -2 actually comes out of ORS, is it 87? Anyway, that actually was lifted out of the insurance language, because there's a statement with healthcare insurance language that pretty much is a very broad statement, and that's where that language came.
And Mr. Chair, if I might ask if I could get an answer to the transport companies. I don't see LifeFlight, all those like organizations. Which previously we had talked about, who are certainly most qualified, so could be include credentialing by the FAA and other organizations who also require licensing, i.e. fire department, but most importantly in this case, because I see them not here and I know it's an absolute, all the aviation support companies, the transport, other transport groups. I don't see them included.
Let me jump in on that as well. I just looked at the relating clause, and we certainly could put that type of language into this bill, because the relating clause is broad enough if we wanted to. But really, the purpose of this particular bill was looking at medical emergency personnel or medical personnel that could perform in a disaster type situation, and was not really meant to address the idea of transport companies and the other array of folks. I think that there are probably some other bills that we will see or will be in other committees that will be addressing some of these other issues.
And Mr. Chair,
that in my work on our local emergency plan, we have great concern for the Portland area, in that the only way you can get out of Portland would be by helicopter. I mean, considering the structure of our highway system, and one bridge and we're in trouble if one bridge should be gone. And that is the reason for asking you to seriously put those groups back in and National Guard won't do it, you can require the entire aviation group in the whole state. Maybe the aviation department could work on this, like you said.
Right. And Mr. Chair, if I can add, and this was actually an issue that I think you brought up, Representative Nelson, is that what we're trying to do here is cover people who are volunteering out of their regular job, out of their what they're regularly doing. And what we don't want to do is cover people who are already covered through their normal employment. So that if there were to be a earthquake or a bombing that, let's say, collapsed one of the Capitol Mall buildings, okay, the EMTs that come to respond to that, they're doing their regular job. They're covered under their own insurance. They don't need to be covered by this act. However, if we as the state public health agency or Marion County as the local health department said we need to set up a triage center and we need to get some physicians, nurses, pharmacists, paramedics in there to do some triage as well, and we want to pull some people out of what they're regularly doing and work with us to provide that service, then we want to make sure that they're covered under this. So that we definitely want to cover those people, but as I said, the people who are providing their normal work, they should be covered already.
Mr. Chair, that's what I meant earlier when I asked the first question. Physicians are already covered. All these individuals are ready under the institutions as well as carry their own insurance. So we seem like we're dubious. They're also professionals like the transport companies, and that's what I had a concern. Same thing happens with the Civil Reserve Air Fleet when this is the second time in history, for example, that the craft fleet has been called up. And so I understand that you need to have that authority, and I'm just wondering, how far we've got to go.
Chair Cromwell, Representative Nelson, on these other institutions, and we'll use transport, whether it be, a commercial company or Department of Transportation or the Oregon National Guard, I think we're very well covered under ORS 401, especially when the governor declares a state of emergency, that through our office we can engage all those assets automatically to deal with, and there's no real credentialing system not needed, but we can bring all those assets to bear during an emergency. So those are already in there, and then of course we work with the cities and counties, to use their resources also, and so we'll look at that. And then in addition to that, in this case, as everyone knows, most of the Oregon National Guard's helicopter fleet is in Afghanistan, and so one of the things, this emergency assistance compact that we have with the other states, and then we can work with them to bring in transport capabilities from other states. So I think we're pretty well covered in that area.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, there is a bit of irony in this. I mean, the reality is that you have, for example, employed physicians for hospital facilities who, even under the terms of this act, would not be covered, or nurses, or other personnel in very sophisticated trauma systems otherwise, which I think creates a very fascinating policy dilemma, particularly since the governor, under the Interstate Compact Act, has the authority to ask these personnel to come into the state, and they are under the State Tort Claims Act, as the terms of the act provides. And all public employees involved are under the State Tort Claims Act. At the local, county, and state level are protected from exposure to liability under the terms of that bill. The only people who aren't, who have their own liability coverage, hospitals, physicians, nurses, and others, have unlimited exposure to liability under ordinary negligence, even with this act. And one of the things that has never been addressed, because it's difficult to address, is that a consistent policy to have, where someone volunteers to provide these services, which you want, I assume you want them to do, and have some protection, I would hope you would, but for the circumstance that the individual happens to be employed is potentially exposed to unlimited liability. So that is a dilemma that you get to deal with. I have, and the Medical Association has its views, but I would think, maybe not, but I would think that you would want to be even-handed in the policy that you establish for those that you're really going to need and rely on in what could be a horrible circumstance. But that's why you make a lot of money doing this.
We get paid the big bucks, right?
May I ask the last question, Mr.
Representative Nelson?
I wanted to just point out one situation that related best I could to this, not as an anthrax, but when California had the MedFly, individuals refused to fly the program to eliminate that after it got out of hand with Governor Brown unless the state insured those who were providing the application work. Because, for example, there were 4 million claims for every car that got a drop of, insecticide or pesticide on it, and no operator could, bear that burden. And so I'm just asking, as far as transport companies, as far as the full program, and Lord protect us, I hope, in the event that we would have a massive anthrax or situation like that. But so maybe we need to be further examining mass protection for numerous issues. And I'm wondering who would be called to respond first, first responders in these situations. How's that covered? I mean, would we have categories of, those first called and then ancillary, second tier, third tier, to as the program, unfortunately, would get larger and larger?
I think that that's one of the things this bill is trying to get at.
And the reciprocity, between states when we're on the border of another state. Did Oklahoma City do this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I'm not sure that they did. And in fact, my understanding, if we create a registration system like this, as far as I know, we'd be the only state that has done something like that. But again, I think it is forward thinking and trying to plan for a number of different scenarios. And it's a little difficult to respond to your question because, how many tiers of people we would need and exactly what people we would need would depend totally on the emergency that we're dealing with, and it can be anything from conventional weapons to biological to chemical to radiological. So, who would call and how many people we would need? There's just so many different scenarios we can't say, but we would like to have some forethought so that we've at least done some planning so that we can pull as many of the right people as possible.
Representative Frazanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think another thing, Doctor, would be maybe just a natural disaster as compared to all these other type of things that we've been talking about that this could affect. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Stansky, that's absolutely correct. This is not limited just to acts of terrorism. We take an all-hazards approach, so natural disasters as well would be included.
If I could just, the one assurance I wanted from looking at your amendment and hearing Mr. Gallant, it does appear that licensing would be for individuals to practice within their discipline, understanding such as a heart doctor, he does or she has, she is a physician with certain basic training, and they could in fact be used in setting a bone or whatever it may be, as to maybe not their expertise, but they still would have at least the parameters of that discipline. Is that the type of licensing and certification we're going to provide to these groups?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pruzanski, this is one of the really sticky issues here, because on the one hand, we do want to make sure that whatever service is being provided is a high quality service, and so as much as possible, we would want people to be providing within their scope of practice. On the other hand, you could envision scenarios where there were so few resources that you were asking a general physician to do some setting bones or some minor surgery that they don't usually do, to ask you know, a nurse to be doing things that, that really might be considered the practice of medicine in other situations. So as much as possible, we would want to try to keep it within that scope. But I do think that there are times when people might have to go beyond that scope, and possibly at that time, you know, they'd be covered under Good Samaritan Act if it really got to that level of criticality.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. I mean, to me, those are within what I would consider an appropriate scope. What I would be concerned with if you had someone such as a mental health specialist going in and doing surgery. And that's what I want to make certain is on the record that we're not looking at doing.
Right, and Chair Crummell and Representative Przanski, that is exactly what we're trying to protect here, and why we didn't like the original version of this bill that I read it to be, that in an emergency, basically, anyone could say they were doing anything they wanted to in order to try to help the out in the emergency and would be covered. And I just think that that's too broad and puts the state at too much risk if we are going to provide that liability.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Przanski, I think your question leads to what I think needs to be done, which is much more clarification maybe among maybe groups of personnel. I think you really are going to have some differences of activities between surgeons and medical personnel, traditional medical personnel, typically MDs, DOs, probably nurses and others and kind of that, versus maybe the broader scope of providers who may be non-invasive personnel in the traditional sense.
Okay. Did you have another question? I have one other. Scott brought up that while he had all this idle time in January, they had a poll being done. I wonder if we're going to be seeing some of the results in those polls in the Judiciary Committee.
That could be true.
Thank you. Just wanted to preview.
Representative Mabry.
Just a supposed question. Suppose we had a AMA conference in Portland. We had 750 highly qualified physicians from all over the United States, none of whom are licensed in this state, none of whom are registered as emergency health care. And we had a disaster. Is it your position that they would be able to be called into service under these provisions because of I don't remember what you called it, but the governor
called it. State of emergency, yeah, the interstate compact and state of emergency, if I may, Mr. Chairman. Well, first of all, those individuals would, I'm sure, volunteer, first of all, but secondly, they would be under the state Good Samaritan law.
Oh, okay.
That's one. But two, this bill, I don't think, it would not operate unless the governor first declared an emergency. And I believe what is intended is that there would be specifically a mechanism to kick that in. So you have a pre-registry, obviously, in your hypothetical. All of the physicians at the AMA House of Delegates would not obviously be pre-registered with the Oregon registry, but I think they probably would obviously be covered under the Good Samaritan law.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Representative Gibbs.
My question is: would the counties remain protected under these plans, or are the states going to assume the liability if this were to be implemented?
Chair Crummell, Representative Kitts, the way we've written the law, we're really looking at it from the state perspective, so that when eight people became agents of the state, if a county were to invoke these powers, I would assume that they would be, you know, covered under county rather than state. So the way we've written this really is dealing with state level issues.
Thanks, sir.
Okay. Let me if I can go ahead and have you stand down for a moment. I'm just going to add. Well, wait right there for just a second. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on this bill? We do have a couple of others. So let me ask you guys to just stand down for a moment, and then because I think it here very quickly, I do want to get to kind of where we want to go with this. Chris, come on up. I don't have anyone else signed up. That's why I'm going to. I'll just ask if there's anyone else that wants.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Chris Davey with Safe Corporation. I was not signed up to testify, but if you would like me to, I could respond to Representative Avakian's question. Under the terms of this bill, these volunteers would not automatically be considered to be subject workers under the workers' compensation law. So this would not immediately provide protection to them for workers' compensation purposes. And I have had no conversations with the Department of Administrative Services Risk Management, so I don't know where they get their fiscal impact estimate from. I believe that the statute does allow the state and other public bodies to elect to provide coverage for people who are volunteers. And it may be that they are figuring that they would, in fact, elect to bring these people under the workers' compensation law, and that would then, of course, impact the premium that they would be paying.
If I may follow up,
Representative Avakian.
I really appreciate you bringing that up, and my notion is that analysis that you just went through is right. But I wonder if there's an additional part to it in that, even though we call them a volunteer, are they truly legally a volunteer if they're providing a benefit to the state that we otherwise would have been paying for? And I see potential litigation on that issue at some point when somebody gets hurt, and wonder if maybe when we get to a work session or something, if that's an answer we should have.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Avakian, there are, of course, a number of volunteers that are already covered under the law by local election. Volunteer firefighters is a good example. Those are people who are providing a service without remuneration in lieu of paying somebody to provide that service. So I suppose this would be somewhat similar to that. But this bill, as it's worded, and the proposed amendment simply says that these people are agents of the state and doesn't go beyond that in linking it to workers' compensation subjectivity.
Thank you.
I'm just curious, Chris, since you brought up the issue about premiums, would this have an effect on, you know, if the state said, well, yeah, you know, we would, if somebody were injured as they were volunteering in the case of a disaster, and so we would want to cover them for workers' comp type of injuries, would that have an immediate effect on the premiums that, for example, the state of Oregon pays on? I mean, because you wouldn't have a listed worker, you wouldn't have necessarily, you know, so sort of this blanket coverage. Would that have an effect, and what kind of an effect would it be?
Well, Mr. Chair, the premium is based on actual exposure, so there wouldn't be a premium that would be due just on the fact that there may be potentially some volunteers. If there were some volunteers that were enlisted and they provided actual hours of service, then the premium would be computed based on those hours of service and run through the formula of the premium rate and so on. So if it were elected, yes, there would be premium, but there wouldn't be any premium unless there were actual service provided.
Okay. Yes, thank you. Representative Nelson?
Yes. Chris, I'm sorry, I didn't get your last name.
Davey.
Davey.
D-A-V-I-E.
D-A-V-I-E.
Correct.
Mr. Davey, back to this question that Derek asked. If these individuals are covered under an emergency plan policy by a county or a city like the volunteer firemen, but if they're called up by the state, should the state then assume this coverage rather than it still be with the counties and the cities?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, presumably if they were called up by the state and therefore were acting on behalf of the state, then they would be covered under the state's policy.
Okay. Any other questions? Chris, thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wanted to testify on House Bill 2410? Given that, it's interesting. This bill has created or developed a lot more interest than originally thought. And here's what I would like to do. And I would like, Ken, would you like to kind of take the lead on this? And I would like to have you convene a work group. And I would like you to involve, for sure, involve the OMA and the Hospital Association, and probably all of the other groups that you can think of, the optometrists, the naturopaths, the chiropractors, the Nurses Association, the Department of Health, of course, with Dr. Higginson, physicians assistants and pharmacists and anybody else that you can think of, and kind of, I guess, what you might do is just sort of put it out as a y'all come meeting, and then let folks kind of give input and see if the work group can kind of put together one amendment that would sort of cover everything. I think that there's usefulness, and I guess in my simplistic mind, I was kind of looking at it from the standpoint of everyone gets covered by the broad statement that I lifted out of the 87 dot whatever it is code, part of the statute. But and then going from there and taking some of the suggestions that Dr. Higginson has come up with, and then suggestions that you get from DOJ and that sort of thing, and see if we can bring together one. And then before you actually submit it to Legislative Council, what I'd like to do would be to sit in on a meeting with you and kind of see where this is all at. And then once we've done that, we could have an amendment drawn up, and then bring it back for the committee's consideration. And, of course, anybody else on the committee that would want to be involved, I would invite you to. Then we could bring, and what I'd like to do is, if we could, in the next, I know this is kind of a short timeline, but if we could bring this back in a couple of weeks for a work session to kind of bring this all together. I think that there's some real merit in what's trying to be accomplished with this bill. And I know we've taken quite a bit of time with it this morning, but I think that it's something that deserves that kind of time. But I would like to put this thing together so that it's something that can be workable from the standpoint of OEM and offers the flexibility and the simplicity that Dr. Higginson talked about, and make sure also that all of our healthcare different healthcare providers from around the state and in their various disciplines could most certainly be utilized in this kind of a setting. So I appreciate you all working on this, and I'll look forward to hearing back from you on it. And one other comment that I would just make, and that is, Representative Avakian had made a comment about hospitals and the certification process. And actually, one of the things that might even be certified in there as an emergency type of situation is that we have surgical centers around the state. Mm-hmm. That, if the hospitals were just inundated, that maybe, the public health officer could say, okay, we've got this surgical center here that does have a plan, they meet the criteria, we're credentialing them, and we can send folks over there, and it gives another place to staff so that you don't have this massive effect on one particular location. So that's another example, I think, of ways, rather than sort of setting up the MASH unit in Tomacall Park.
I would envision a grade school gymnasium serving the same purpose in certain disasters. And subsection B of the amendments that somebody gave allowed, I think, the Department of Human Services or somebody to designate mm-hmm. it as such. And
sure.
I just wondered if maybe when the committee meets, we would streamline that. I mean, I can see in the middle of a disaster people trying to call to get authorization to set something up, and how difficult that might be with communications down, if there might be a way to streamline that.
Sure. So that's another thought to sort of add in here as well. So anyway, I just want to say thank you. And
can I just add one thing, Mr. Chair?
Representative Nelson?
Thank you. Last week when we were under the orange alert, and we were named, this entity was named as one of those potential targets. I had asked at that time that we all be apprised of our emergency plan, since this relates to emergencies. And, in line with this, in that case, nothing was done. So I'm concerned that, this facility, for example, or other facilities could be filled with numerous people, and you know, if we did our due diligence in taking care of those issues to prevent great liability and also certainly to provide protection for individuals in those, and I saw no, there was no response from the state for any of those potential churches, government entities, as was brought up in the media. So I think we need to consider facilities in a huge picture and do it now.
Okay. Thank you. With that, and thank you again all for coming, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2410. And since we don't have anything else before us, we will stand adjourned and see you all Tuesday. Thank you.
Thank you.